Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. From the New York Times bestselling author of Room and The Pull of the Stars, a Madonna who takes readers on a ride through turn-of-the-century Paris on the edge of a dazzling future in her novel, The Paris Express. It is autumn, 1895. Paris is chaotic as it is glamorous, with industry and invention creating huge wealth and terrible poverty. One morning, an anarchist boards the ill-fated Granville to Paris Express train, determined to make her mark on history. Aboard the train are others from across the globe, the railway crew who have built a life together away from their wives, a little boy traveling alone for the first time, an artist far from home, a wealthy statesman and his invalid wife, and a young woman with a secret. Emma Donoghue is the author of 16 novels, including the award-winning national bestseller Room, the basis for the acclaimed film of the same name. Other novels include Pull of the Stars, Frog Music, Haven, Wonder, and Learned by Heart. The new novel is The Paris Express, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Emma Donoghue to this week's book show.
We have to speed through this because we have to get Emma on a train after she's talked about her book about a train disaster. Yes!
If we were actually in Ireland, we could count on the train to be a good quarter of an hour late.
So that's right.
Make it all much easier.
Perfect. I thank you very, very much for being here. It's an absolute delight to have you on the book show. I love this book. I just so enjoy.
Thank you, cousin. I've just assumed that we are cousins if we go far enough
back. I would assume so. The Donahue is O-G-H-U-E in your spelling. My spelling, D-O-N-A-H-U-E. But it's all pretty much
the same. We're all from Kerry.
Yes.
You know, we were known as the Kings of Kerry, but that was a purely metaphorical phrase. We were, I think, all, you know, the peasants of Kerry.
Do you consider yourself, if there is such a thing, do you consider yourself an Irish writer?
I do, absolutely, because I was there for the first 20 years, and those are the 20 years that mark you and shape you.
And what do you think makes an Irish writer an Irish writer?
Some sort of connection to the land or people of Ireland, I suppose. And I've now written many things set in various countries I've lived in, including Ireland, England, France, Canada, America. But, you know, the root of it all is still Ireland. If I was going to generalize a bit more than that, I would say the Irish are known for, it's not always a gift, but gab, certainly. Gab by the truckload. And my characters talk a lot, and I find dialogue by far the easiest part of any book to spin.
Which is what's wonderful about this novel, because we'll get to the point of it in a moment, but there are characters who are in various train cars, and we meet them through the conversations they have. And that is so fascinating, because if we were to take a 3-hour, 5-hour train ride, that's how we're going to meet people. And it's fascinating how you do that and how beautiful those conversations are.
I think I was very influenced by the late, lovely Maeve Binchy, who did a column in the Irish Times where she just shamelessly eavesdropped. And I don't know how she managed to eavesdrop, because she was a very well-known figure and physically quite distinctive and took up space in every sense. So I don't know how she got away with it. Maybe she hid behind a newspaper. But every week there'd be a hilarious article in which she reported what she heard over her shoulder. So that's the kind of vibe I was trying to go for.
What brought you to this train disaster in 1895?
We were going to spend a year in Paris. My partner is a professor of French. She's French originally. And every now and then when she gets a sabbatical, we go and plunge our children into French and French culture. So this time around, we were going to Paris, and it's quite hard to find a 3-bedroom apartment there. The French live in a very compact way, even in elegant parts of Paris. So I happened to find us one on sabbaticalhomes.com in Montparnasse, which I didn't really know as an area of Paris, because it's not very known by tourists apart from the catacombs. So I thought, well, I just Googled the area to see did anything interesting ever happen there. And the first thing I saw was this extraordinary photograph from October 22nd, 1895. Apparently, it's quite a beloved dorm room photo, but I was never in residence. I went to university while still living at home with my mammy, so I never had that experience. And this amazing image shows a train plunging almost vertically out a window. And there's something about that, you know, I've always wanted to write about a disaster of some kind, because disasters bring such a cross-section of people together and put their character to the test. But this particular disaster, I think, seized me because the photographs produced when people rush to the scene and, you know, set up their cameras to look through all the smoke and dust, the photographs produced all have this quality of sort of high-tech madness. You know, it's such an impressive train and yet it's hanging upside down.
The photographs are amazing, and it would seem that could certainly propel a story in and of itself. But really, in the end, that it's getting there to that point that is so fascinating, that journey that we're on, that is still so incredibly satisfying.
Well, I knew immediately that I would use the train journey to give shape to the novel, because it would be a crime to write a loose, baggy, long-winded story about a fast train journey. So I thought my novel has to have the qualities of an express train journey. It starts when the train is taking off. It ends a couple of minutes after the train stops. And I knew that it would have to be, you know, a lean, mean machine, even though it contains dozens of people. So that really kind of set the rules for the project for me.
There are so many characters, and we can't get to all of them, but I'd like to point out just a few. But one is a young boy who is traveling by himself. He's about 7, I believe. And he is, everyone in his family thinks he's old enough to travel by himself. Probably not, but they think he is. And they pack him up and they put him on the train. Reading from his vantage point of you exploring and telling his story is so beautiful, because it is that wide-eyed, what are all these people doing, that is so fascinating from a child's perspective.
I wanted somebody to see the Eiffel Tower for the first time. So I thought, I want a kid on board. You know? And then I thought, who was a kid in 1895 in northern France? And I came across somebody who would go on to be a French resistance hero and killed by the Nazis. And I thought, you know, he was 7 and the train was passing through his part of Normandy. I'm going to put that kid on the train, not at the moment when he sort of enters into history in the big serious way that he would, but at a random moment of his childhood when he's so kind of open and to experience and observing everything. And I thought in particular that kid would be fascinated by the fact that French train stations kept their clocks out by 5 minutes to give people the impression that they were on time. You know, when you dash up to the station, think, you don't know, I'm late. And then you'd be like, oh, it's okay. You know, it was a little convenience for the passengers.
So when the train is running late, it's really running late.
It really is running late, but inside the train stations, they kept the clocks back 5 minutes just to allow for human frailty.
Yes, yeah. Dawdlers, I believe, right? Is that what you refer to them as?
Dawdlers, yes. I'm a perpetual dawdler myself. So, you know, my most vivid memory of a train, for instance, is I would remember any train that I've missed by being late, or when I got on the wrong train as a young au pair in Brussels. I got on the train heading north out of Brussels instead of south, and I'll never forget that gathering fear of, like, the sun has set, the night is darkening, and I don't recognize this landscape at all. I'm heading towards the Netherlands. Because in Europe, you can change country quite quickly and hardly without even noticing.
Emma Donoghue is our guest. The name of the new book is The Paris Express. The book is just out from Summit Books. You mention the young child who is based on a real figure. What brought you to who was going to be invented and who was going to be real on the train talking on those cars in various classes of train cars?
The point about a train is that it's mass transit. So I knew there'd be maybe 100 people on there. So I couldn't, it would have seemed perverse to make the novel be about just a few. But I only knew the names of a small handful of the passengers, because even though 40 different newspaper articles about this disaster came out, they only mentioned a few of the bigger names, some members of parliament, members of the National Assembly who were on it, and a bullet manufacturer, Monsieur Gévelot, who produced most of the bullets used in the American Civil War. So there were a lot of carriages and we didn't know who was in them. And so I decided I'd need to populate them. But because 1890s France was such an amazingly diverse multicultural city, it was a hub. It was a place that people went to if they wanted more personal freedom or education, or if they were inventing. One of my characters would go on to invent the Paris Metro, for instance. I've got people selling cars, people inventing moving pictures. It was just a place where anyone with a lot of energy and spark and curiosity went to. A lot of expatriate painters, for instance, lots of them American. So I thought, I don't need to simply make up lots of interesting characters. Paris was absolutely full of them. So I decided it would be a pleasing exercise if I found people who could have been on my train.
And there is a character who is thinking of ending it all.
Yes. When the train crashed, the journalists asked the locals in Montparnasse in Paris what they thought when they heard the noise. And several of them independently said, oh, we assumed it was a bomb, you know, an anarchist bomb. Because already big city people had that kind of, you know, get on with your day attitude, even though they knew random disaster could strike. And the terrorism in the 1890s was very much coming from the extreme left. The French president had been stabbed to death the year before. There'd been bombs in restaurants and in the parliamentary assembly itself. So I thought, well, what if there was a bomber on that train, just to complicate the narrative? And I looked around at who the radicals were in those days. And I thought, instead of the usual anarchist character who'd be a sort of a skulking, you know, Eastern European man, very gaunt in his 40s or 50s, I thought, I'm going to go for a young woman. So I found someone who was in sort of radical circles and could have been in a position to think of bringing the entire train down with her at that moment.
And as the novel progresses, there's the sense of that she wants to do this, and yet the reasoning sort of starts to falter, right? Of exactly what it is that she wants to accomplish with this very, very violent act.
This young woman, Madeleine Pelletier, who, I should say, we have no proof that she ever made a bomb, but she was angry enough to make a bomb. She was full of righteous wrath about the oppression of the poor and of women. She, I think, has a lot of good points, but of course, what was so baffling about the anarchist cause was that they were never that clear how blowing things up would help. You know? And I'm fascinated by these genuinely zealous, idealistic, disturbed people, especially young ones, actually, you know, the people who are willing to throw away their own lives in a cause and who are often manipulated by the elders of that cause. I'm fascinated by all the goodness in them, which has turned to the bad. So I thought it would be really interesting to take someone who clearly had a huge amount of good to do in the world. But if I caught her at a moment when she was just raging and couldn't see any possibility of doing good, that she might, you know, convince herself in that naive and adolescent way that it would genuinely save the world to blow it all up.
This is a relatively long train ride.
Well, it's covering a lot of France. It's from the Normandy coast all the way to Paris, yeah. And they were going at top speed. And speed is really the heart of the novel, because when I was trying to work out why this crash happened, I mean, you know, the railways in France were a well-oiled machine in themselves. It was all incredibly... it was a very busy network that covered all of France, and they went very fast and reliably and punctually. But I found that the companies, the railway companies, insisted on speed so that all the customers would get to Paris on time. So even though there was technically a speed limit, the company would be like, if any time gets, you know, lost along the way, if there are any delays, be sure to make up that time and get to Paris on time. So there was a, you know, it was one of those mixed messages you get from an employer. And I also found that the staff, the crew of the train, got a bonus every Christmas if their work was good, meaning did they get there on time. But also the driver and the stoker, the two who were running the actual engine, if they could save on water and coal, but also get there fast on time every day, they got a massive bonus. Like their salary would be topped up by about 40%. So the company was literally inducing them to speed. And what happened that day to delay things was that one very privileged passenger, one of the members of parliament, Christophe, he asked if the train could stop in his village, an unscheduled stop, to put his personal private carriage on, which took 10 minutes. So basically one ruined it for everyone. One rich asshole. And it seems that as a result, the driver and the stoker seem to have determined we will make up those 10 minutes. And so they dashed into Paris too fast.
Because as that happens, the crew of the train, their heads are exploding. They're just like, this is going to throw us off. And
see, in Ireland, they'd have been fine. They'd be like, 10 minutes, what's the difference? We'll have a cup of tea, you know? But, you know, France in the 1890s was a place of modernity and speed and efficiency. And, you know, it was the love of tech, for one thing. You know, my train is absolutely full of people who are enamored of technologies, from bicycles or skiing or electric cars. You know, they're all like, this is the future. This is wonderful. Let's speed on no matter what the cost.
Did anyone get cut from the novel?
Yes, plenty of people. And a few people I considered, and they were just too famous. It was like a sort of, you know, odd audition process where you say to yourself, oh, Sandra Bernhardt, I'm sorry, you're going to be distracting. You know, you can't get on board. But there were also people I wrote even several scenes from their point of view. And then I just thought, you may be an interesting person, but you're not having a very interesting day on the 22nd of October, 1895. And they didn't have to be, had to be having a very dramatic day, but an interesting one. So there's one character whose struggles are almost all internal. He's the American painter, Henry Ossawa Tanner. He's just sitting quietly on that train, but a novel lets you get into somebody's head. And what we know is that he's suffering such acute tension because there he is riding along in second class and he's used to American trains where a man of color could not be in anything other than the colored car. So he's sitting there in a cold sweat on this French train thinking, am I really all right here or will the guard kick me out? So that's one thing I love about novels, that they can kind of, you know, just, you know, jump into the head of each character in turn and reveal all the tiny little dramas that are going on behind the eyes.
And he just can't really believe that, and still always throughout it has these push and pull, right, of how he feels, of where he is and where he can go and what he can do.
Absolutely. I was very interested in the expats. For instance, down in the third class carriage, which was designed to be uncomfortable, they used to bore little holes in the floor to make drafts so that you'd be like, this sucks, I'm going to pay for second class next time. You know. So I have a young drifter Irish student you know, who lives on the occasional boiled egg, John Singh. He would go on to be a famous playwright, but he doesn't know that in 1895. He just thinks of himself as a loser who he's always getting crushes on girls and doing nothing about it. And I have him encountering this dazzling East Asian model, Anna, who we know only from Gauguin's paintings of her. And she enters into history just through this one anecdote that she was Gauguin's you know, model, probably mistress. She seems to have been really a trafficked teenager. We don't know exactly where she came from, possibly Java. But anyway, when Gauguin was out of town, she sold all his furniture and ran away. So I just think that one act of rebellion earned her a place in my novel. So you know, I bring her and young John Singh together and let the spark fly between them. So I just, it was like planning an amazing dinner party, really, just bringing together all these people and seeing how they might see each other and how they might connect with each other.
Did you ever think in your mind consciously in a cinematic fashion?
having had two of my novels turn into films, I'm always aware of it as a possibility, but I try not to let that affect the writing of the fiction, because if I start a project in the form of a novel, it's because I think it's the best form to start it. It's the one that allows the most detailed world building. There's literally, in a novel, time for all the conversations and all the descriptions, and you don't have to sort of streamline or cut to the chase. It's a wonderfully leisurely form, even a relatively propulsive and fast, thrillerish book like this one. So I try and keep the thought of film at bay, even though some of my projects have ended up on film, because I just think each art form offers such advantages of its own. I've had the great pleasure, for instance, with my novel Room, of doing it as a novel and then as a play and then as a film. And in each case, instead of it being a sort of three-part ego trip, it's actually more like I come away going, wow, the novel is great at getting into a child's head. And wow, a film is astonishing for naturalistic detail and verisimilitude. And wow, a theatre production is wonderful for making the audience feel that they are entering into a kind of a mutual game with the performers. So I love doing adaptation because it makes you so aware of the pleasures and challenges of each of these art forms.
All right, so two things. One, with all of that said, this just seems like it's a movie waiting to be made.
I wouldn't say no.
No. Why would you? It's amazing. When it comes to Room, was it the novel first?
Yes. With each of these, it's the novel first. And again, with The Wonder, it was a novel first. And I think that's the right sequence, because I think a film can be hugely powerful by stripping away a lot of the detail, but the rich imagining has been done to begin with in the form of a novel. Whereas if you began with a film and then produced a novelization, it probably wouldn't have that richness of thought behind it. I love the process, for instance, of taking a novel, mine or somebody else's book. I recently adapted Helen MacDonald's amazing memoir, H is for Hawk, that's going to be a film with Claire Foy in it next year. And so to take any book and to whittle it down and choose only the best lines of dialogue, for instance, it's an amazing sort of distillation process. And funny thing about filmmaking is that sometimes you take away all the dialogue and yet the scene still works. You know, so say some of the scenes that Florence Pugh had as the nurse in my film of The Wonder on Netflix, you know, she had read all the lines. So even though the lines ended up being cut, she knows them and they're in her mind. So she's communicating them all just by a look. So it's a fascinating process of taking one element of a page, like, say, dialogue, and boiling it down to flavor the rest.
Did the success of all forms of Room surprise you?
I do feel astonishingly lucky that I happened on a storyline which has mattered so much to so many people and such a variety of people. And when you write a bestseller, you realize the different ways that people can read the same book. So I get letters saying, you know, I'm doing my PhD on, you know, the influence of Freud on your book. And then you get a letter from someone else saying, I just bought your book in Walmart. That kid is so cute. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. They are each finding something for themselves in it.
But I understand the point. Sure. H is for Hawk. So how did you get on that list?
I don't know how I got asked to do it, but it was such a treat. Anytime I've adapted someone else's work, but this is the first time it's actually made it to the screen, I have felt like this tiny figure climbing inside an amazing machine made by somebody else and figuring out how it works, you know, studying a book from the inside, the intimacy of it. And you also feel slightly, nerve-wracked, like mustn't mess it up. So many people have loved this book. And in particular, H is for Hawk is such an amazingly genre-bending book in that it's a memoir of grief, basically, about, you know, when her father died. But it's also a book of nature writing. It's a book about falconry. It's a book about sort of cultural history. And I remember thinking, like, oh, some of the fans might be mad with me, but I have to find the through line. You know, a feature film has to have a clear through line. So it's quite a responsibility.
Do you contact Helen and say?
No, I just got approached out of the blue, and I hadn't even heard of her book, so they sent it to me, and I immediately said, yes, please.
But once you have the gig, do you want to get in her head or
no? Well, you mostly want to get in her head in the form of the book that she wrote. But yes, I did contact her for some extra details and also permission. I would say to her, like, do you mind if I change your brother's job to something else? Or do you mind if I change that detail? And yes, she and her family and friends were all very relaxed about it. In fact, they lent a lot of her beloved father, you know, a lot of his real photographs and possessions and things in his office. The family lent them for use in the film, so that the film becomes a kind of, you know, beautiful memorial to him, you know.
And Claire Foy, hello.
I know. Yeah, so just before Christmas, I was in Wales on that set, watching a fascinating part of the filmmaking process. I was watching the assistant director direct the extras. It was a funeral scene. And so he's saying, like, you in the red coat, we've seen too much of you, step to the left, you know. He's, you know, moving all the little pieces around.
And but also to be on that set and not be the person who wrote the original work, as you did with Room, must be a little of a relief, too.
Yeah, certainly. I would find it terribly exposing to be making a film about my own life sort of thing. I think that's quite a task for Helen. But I've enjoyed them all. I think anytime I've been on a film set, I feel I can't believe we've made it this far, because, you know, the many obstacles that prevent the financing of films mean that, you know, most writers have projects that are stuck in endless development, as I do, too. So I can't believe the three of them have actually made it to the big screen.
And as we wrap up, but just to be in a room, alone as a writer working on a book like The Paris Express seems unparalleled as freedom, excitement, joy.
And, you know, it never feels as if you're alone. That's the thing. I feel as if I've spent my morning with dozens of people on a moving train. It's so vivid to me. If I think back on all the time I spent while either in Paris or since at home in Canada on that train, they feel hugely sociable and interactive. So it's very strange then to think that I made them all up in my head.
Emma Donoghue is the author of the new book, The Paris Express. It is just out. It is published by Summit. I can't tell you what a thrill it is to speak to you, and I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I can think of no better way to spend a rainy St. Patrick's Day than this one.
Emma Donoghue's new novel is The Paris Express. It is published by Summit Books. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Thanks also to the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, odysseybks.com. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donoghue.